Welcome back to Pax Europiana, the podcast about peace in Europe. And I will talk now about EU Days again. It's the 27th of February, and that's a very special day in European history. And it's the day to condemn the annexation of Crimea by the Russian Federation. And this was the day when basically it happened, and this kind of staged military coup with some political accomplices. The Russian Federation, as a punishment for the pro-Western turn of Ukraine in the Euromaidan events in Kiev, and they have basically made this fast-track plan. The moment Yanukovych has left, and he fled basically after he was deposed by the Ukrainian parliament, he fled to Russia. And in that evening already, it was on the 21st of February to the 22nd in the night where he fled. Then on the 22nd already, there was an emergency sitting and meeting in the Russian Security Council. And they have made the decision to take Crimea, because that is really important for them. Why it's important? Because of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. And that is basically all the ships the Soviet Union had in the south, in the Black Sea. And this was one of these problems, you know, in this complicated separation, divorce and breakup of the Soviet Union in the winter of 91. And there was a lot of complicated deals made. You know, normally when states separate, they divide the debt equally, the military assets, the assets abroad. All this is done properly in a way that according to the size of the country. And there is a share of the debt, a share of the assets, a share of everything is basically given. But in the way that was done in the Soviet Union, unfortunately, it was not like this. The Russians took all the debt, and then they wanted to have all the assets as well. And they wanted especially the important military assets. And this Black Sea Fleet in the history of Russia has a huge significance. And they kept it, and they wanted to keep it stationed in Crimea, because where else? Yeah? No, there would have been actually some Russian outlets to the Black Sea, but they were not ready for that. And with that, obviously, they had a huge military presence in Ukraine. They also had a lot of people on their payroll. At the moment in 2014, I know the number, it was over 25,000 Russian soldiers in Crimea, in Sevastopol, at the moment of takeover and annexation. That was already very helpful when you want to military take over that peninsula. And basically, it was like that. It was a complicated divorce, and I will discuss all the reasons now in this podcast. But first of all, let me say the huge significance of this shattering event. Because why? Normally, annexations are not done. That's against the system of the international system since the Second World War. Basically, in many ways, the Second World War was about annexation. It was exactly about the German Empire under Hitler. He was basically having the idea of annexing territories which he felt were somehow his due or should be for ethnical, linguistical, historical reasons in the German Empire. And he felt that this was whatever the peace in Versailles and the situation was unfair. And he wanted to what he called Heim ins Reich, that what the philosophy was, get the German population of the Czech Republic, of Poland, of Austria especially, back into the empire. That was the philosophy of Greater Germany, which he proposed. Yeah? And so ultimately, the real comparison between the Russia taking in Crimea must be made between the Germans and Austria in 1938. Because it was very similar. Of course, you know, more famous, obviously, is the Russian fantasy to compare it with Kosovo. But Kosovo is a completely different case for many reasons. I will explain in a moment. But the real logical comparison is what Hitler did to Austria. Because Austria also linguistically is the same. We don't speak very good German in Austria, but we speak German, obviously. Yeah? also to the Crimean people. The people in Crimea spoke Russian and speak Russian to this day, obviously. Yeah? And also many people in Crimea identify themselves ethnically as Russians, obviously. Not the Crimean Tatars. There's also a lot of Ukrainians, but also the Ukrainians who were living in Crimea spoke Russian, because most, if not all Ukrainians, they speak Russian also as a second language, and many of them as a first language. And so the situation is exactly comparable with Austria, because also in Austria, linguistically, most people in Austria at that time, especially after the First World War, in the difficult times of the separation of the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy, and they were absolutely feeling as German. The idea to feel as Austrian, that was very strange for people in 1918, 1919. Of course, they knew that they were Habsburg subjects, but they didn't feel that most of them felt that they were Germans. It's quite obvious. Yeah? Obviously, today everything is different and everything is now to be understood in the light of the crimes of the Second World War. But in the year in 1918, 1919 and 1920, and in all those years, there is no doubt about it that the Austrians, who were then basically left over with this huge empire, and many of them, they felt definitely very German. There is no doubt about it. And obviously Hitler, who was also born in Austria, in the border region to Germany, and who lived in Vienna in the years before the First World War, he definitely felt it like this, and he definitely took back Austria by force. Just let's not kid ourselves. When you have, even to the internal shame of the Austrian government, you didn't use force against it. The problem was that there was huge, massive threat level of military force by Hitler against Schuschnigg. That was the prime minister of Austria back then. And I can make a separate podcast about the Anschluss and explain that in due time. But it's very much the same what happened, because in Crimea, it was very clear that the Russians have the overwhelming military force. They had 25,000 soldiers of the Russian Federation based in Crimea. They also had a week to prepare and fly in whoever they needed to take the key military assets and control basically the leverages of power, which are, for example, like the key artillery, the air base of Belek, that's the main military air base there, and to make sure that the heavy weapons are in the hand of the Russians, the communication tools are in the hand of the Russian military, and they flew in the special forces, this famous green men, who were absolutely of no loyalty towards Ukraine, because they were just coming in and they were trained soldiers. There's amazing videos of the standoffs. If you want to look on YouTube, there's amazing standoffs between the Ukrainian loyal soldiers and the Russian soldiers in Crimea, shouting each other in Ukraine. And you could see the interviews of the people which were basically fighting together. They were born in the Soviet Union together, and they were so close in the families, and the division line, who was really loyal to whom, was often going very, very much into the family. The one interview is very touching of the one Ukrainian officer loyal to Ukraine. He was then standing there without weapons, and he was saying, "My father, he was a Soviet officer. He is against what I'm doing here." And, you know, it was really for the dramatic level of personal infliction. It's hard to imagine. And it's exactly also, never forget, Austria and Germany were together fighting in the First World War. It was also only 20 years before when the war was lost together. And obviously the Austrian soldiers and officers, they knew all the German officers. And then to fight against each other whenever there was no chance to really win in such a confrontation. And that basically also the perception of spilling brotherly blood. That was the case also in 1938. Yeah, certainly it was our shame. And certainly the Ukrainians, I would like to make it very clear, the Ukrainians were ready to spill a lot of blood later when they were consolidated as a democracy and they had the political consolidation process done. They were retaking militarily as much as they could. in Donbass. So you cannot say that the Ukrainians were not ready for a fight. They were just overwhelmed because they themselves couldn't really believe it. You see this kind of unbelief in the eyes of the officers there that this is really happening. And it happened basically as a revenge act against the Euromaidan, which of course for Putin was a terrible thing. Yeah, he was so personally involved in Ukraine. Ukraine is so important for the Russians, for defense industry, strategic reputation. I mean, this is their first colony, which they got 350 years ago. And they then lost it in the Euromaidan. And that was, of course, in the moment when Russia felt again like a big power. Putin, just in his third term in 2013, starting the first year over. And then he lost Ukraine. And what he got, actually, he got 7% of the land of Ukraine and about, all in all, 5 million people in two terrible international outlawed operations. He got it, yeah. But the Ukrainians, most of them, 93%, and 93% of the population, 40 million people, are free, are part of the free world now, and will join NATO and the EU. So he is the big loser on the whole operation. But, you know, of course, he could make what big powers do. Might is right in the world of the 19th century and before. You get what you can get. And he took the Crimea by force. And we will never recognize it. It will be never his legally. It will be never a Russian Federation territory in a term which is internationally recognized, because that he should have learned also from the power struggles of the big powers in the 19th century, that without recognition by the other powers, you can take a lot of land and you can be a great empire. But if you never regularly get any legitimacy by the other big powers, you are basically occupying Paria, and this is exactly what Russia has turned with this deed. And they know it very well. The Russian elite is very well briefed about international law. They knew they did it wrong. And then they tried to find a lot of excuses, and they tried to somehow legalize it with a lot of international propaganda and internal propaganda. And also with, you know, they knew, of course, the Austrian case. Also, Hitler did a referendum then in April. But what is a referendum when you have already created facts, when you already have taken a lot of people in concentration camps, when you then stage kind of self-legitimizing referendum under duress? I mean, this is in history. Napoleon was the master of doing referendum, and all dictators have copied it from him, because the thing is always, then you can claim this is the will of the people, and you manipulate referendums in the style of Napoleon or Hitler. And what Putin did then in March 2018 was exactly this, yeah, 16th of March. Obviously, nobody can really say what would have been the result under free conditions, because once the military facts are done, and everybody who goes then to a vote understands what he has to do if he wants to be part of that system in the future. And obviously they know also how to manipulate the results. And very, obviously then you have to create a big pro vote. And they have created 95, similar like Hitler created 95 in Austria. If you want to look at it, it's quite interesting. In the 38 referendum, they even had two boxes, a yes and a no, and the yes was double the size than the no. So even for everybody to understand what is supposed to cross. And that didn't happen in Crimea, but I'm sure everybody was very clear what should happen. And so it happened. Later he tried to legitimize it with a lot of stories about the past. And I will first of all explain a little bit more how then he bought the elite consensus. You know, financially, obviously, under pressure. What you need to do, there was also Ukrainian army on forces, and then you have to talk with the key generals, and then you promise them, for example, an apartment at the Black Sea and some future position in the Russian army, and so you can somehow neutralize the opponents. Additionally, at that time, until 2014, Russia was much more successful than it's now because of the consequent fall of the oil prices and the high costs of the Syrian war and the Ukrainian war and the sanctions as well, especially the ones Russia has imposed against us. They were more hurting the Russian economy than ours because we are much richer. And the Russian economy has tanked. The ruble has tanked several times in the meantime. And basically, these great living standards, which the Russians were promising to the Crimeans, they have not appeared. Additionally, obviously, no Ukrainian can really go for tourism easily to Crimea again under this condition, with the border, with the negative publicity attached to it, and also with the basically disgust for that. So basically, most of the tourism accommodation the Russians are now building additional, because they have money to invest, but it's very complicated for Russian tourists to go there. And so basically, it's a lot is empty, and they are now at whatever 30% capacity of the pre-2014 levels. And that's, of course, a big problem. And despite the massive costs of the Russian occupation for Crimea, for Russia, in the terms of infrastructure, they have basically inherited a huge level of a liability. It's estimated by Russian independent think tanks, 3 billion euro or dollar is the costs of the Russian occupation for the Russian taxpayers for Crimea. So basically, that's very costly, and that will stay very costly, because there was one reason why Crimea was attached to Ukraine in 54. That's basically because it makes more sense. And there's other reasons as well, I will elaborate. But basically, when you look at the geography, you see this peninsula, the only land access is to Crimea, to Ukraine. And basically here, the electricity comes, the water comes, the easy access by train comes. And of course, now they have built this famous bridge, another $5 billion investment. Congratulations, actually, it's quite an infrastructure achievement. So they are very serious, the Russians, about keeping it. But, you know, I can guarantee you, Crimea will never legally be theirs. It's always a booty. It's an occupied territory for everybody in the world. And it will never be legally theirs. There is no way. And it will simply not happen. Let me also explain the history, because that plays a lot of discussions. On the same legitimacy that Russia wants to have Crimea, the Vienna government in Austria today could claim basically most of Central Europe. Historically, it was owned by the Habsburg Empire. And if you look at the map of Europe in the 19th century, or if you want to go back to before Napoleon, that's basically the claim they have. It is basically possible for the Austrian Habsburg monarchy to come up and to claim about all of the Balkans, large parts of Germany and Italy and Poland and Czechoslovakia and, you know, Romania. So basically, this is the legitimacy. It's based on some kind of historic approach. If we would go back then, we could basically claim half of Europe in Austria. And by the way, we are not going to do that. Yeah, and it's similar ridiculous to claim the Crimean thing on history. Because how, in short nutshell, I will tell you the history of that one. It was part of the Ottoman Empire for all time, since the Ottomans have conquered Constantinople and then the Black Sea, and they have basically inherited by conquest the claim to the Roman Eastern Roman Empire, which is now called Byzantinian Empire, and basically basically taken that by conquest in the year 1453, which is well documented, and then they have also taken the former possessions of the Byzantine Empire over time on the Balkans before even, because the city was one of the last strongholds, but then they conquered everything at the Black Sea as well, which took a little bit of more time. And basically, that's about it. And then it's also important to understand the European history of Eastern Europe as a gigantic struggle between Russia and Turkey for this moment. Basically, Russia was then gradually rising. The Turkish Ottoman Empire was rising from that moment. and they clashed continuously for 500 years. Basically, that's also the story of the First World War. And to some extent, they have then in the year there was this big there was a permanent war between Russia and Turkey in that years, 500 years long. And in 1776, that's basically just before the Napoleonic Wars and the Russian Revolution, and the German Queen of Russia, Katharina, she took this southern Russian, now it's called southern Russian, but basically she was fighting against the Turkish Empire, and she gradually took over Crimea, or annexed and integrated. It was in 1738. And the treaty, which was in a way the one of the many peace treaties or whatever armistices, it's called Kurchuk-Kacharna, if I pronounce it correctly. It was in 1774. And basically, there Crimea was meant to be an independent state as a kind of a buffer state in order to break it away from the Ottoman Sultan. But that didn't last very long. In 1783, she has annexed that. And then she made a lot of deals with the Austrian Empire. It's important to understand that the Russian Tsar and the Austrian Kaiser and the Sultan, they were competing for the idea to be the successor of the Eastern Roman Empire. And that is called in history the Katharina's Greek Project. She was having already very detailed plan what to do with European Turkey, basically to create a new Byzantine Empire, to give Bosnia to Austria, as it happened then later. And it was then also to have the Venetians in the Adriatic. Basically, that is her Greek project. She had actually a grandson already named Constantine to be the emperor of that new Byzantine Empire. So, but the situation was made without the French Revolution and without the French Napoleonic Wars, which was keeping the Russians and the Austrians pretty busy for the next 25 years. And despite the great summit, it was actually in 1783 that Emperor Joseph and Katharina, they met actually in Crimea to make all these plans, and they have divided the world among themselves, but they didn't make a really great agreement with the other great powers in the world. And so actually that was more a fantasy project. But it kept obviously the Russian politics very busy, because the moment Napoleon was defeated, the Russian attention returned back to the Black Sea, because the Black Sea is the Crimea, the Black Sea, Constantinople, the Bosporus, the access to the Mediterranean. That was really very important. And that is then called in history the Eastern Question. Basically, the same plan was then cooked up again, how to divide the Ottoman Empire. And the Russians really wanted to do it. And the Austrians were in some aspects complicit with it. Whenever Austria, after the Napoleon Wars, was never again such a powerful country like it was before still. It was very much defeated, and it gradually failed due to internal struggles and fragilities, and also to a too high focus on the status quo. But that's a topic for another day. So ultimately, the Crimea was just in the Napoleonic times integrated in the Russian Federation, in the Russian Empire at that time. And you can obviously say, yes, but that is a basis for the claim. But also Ukraine was part of that empire. And basically everything was divided then when the Soviet Union was divided in 91. I will come back to that one in a second. But let me make the story about 54, because in 54, obviously then is this famous story which Putin always says, that Khrushchev has presented Crimea to Ukraine. But, you know, let's make a point here. It was all the Soviet Union. There was no doubt about it. Yeah? So nobody was thinking that somebody will break away one day. That was, in the perspective, quite impossible. But it was logically more to have it administratively attached to Ukraine, because that's geography. And also Crimea is and will always be a luxury item. It cannot pay its own costs. It needs the massive subsidies because of its geography. In every aspect, it's a luxury item to have, like a holiday house in a way, but it always needs support. It will never be able to really earn with a tax base its own costs. That is much too complicated internally, a desert, than all this lack of access anywhere, and it's a massive loss-making thing. And it was also the idea to somehow change the ethnic balance in Ukraine, because it was already 1 million Russians living in Crimea. And so basically that was much more the idea, to ingratiate maybe to the Ukrainian elite. That's possible. But let's never forget that the Ukrainians in that phase after Stalin's death and this power struggle between the various political factions, between Malenkov and Khrushchev and Beria, and how these terrible people are all called. It was absolutely a question of what to shall be happening. And Ukraine was the battlefield of the Second World War. It was the victim of the Holodomor, of the Stalin's hunger enforced campaign to collect all the grain and to take into account millions and millions of Ukrainians dying. So after the Khrushchev speech at the Congress in 54, there was a necessity, after all this was also in the public discourse, there was a necessity somehow to make a gesture towards Ukraine, that Ukraine is an integral part of the Soviet Union and not just an exploited victim by Stalin, which in fact it was. Additionally, never forget, there was a huge civil war inside the Soviet Union in Western Ukraine of highest brutality, which Khrushchev himself waged as the party chairman of the Ukrainian Republic against the insurgents who until the 52-53 have led a wild campaign for independence of Western Ukraine, which unfortunately also the West didn't help at all, and it was a tragedy. Anyhow, so it happened, and it was a legal transfer inside the Soviet Union. And then I would like to remind shortly that when the Soviet Union was divided, and Ukraine had about one-third of the nuclear weapons on its territory, and there was a so-called Budapest Memorandum, which was very clear that Ukraine's sovereignty, including Crimea, is accepted by the Russian Federation. Therefore, the Ukrainians have transported the nuclear weapons back to Russia, or towards Russia, not back to Russia, because they were always in Ukraine. And that was also signed by the Americans and by the British. So it is on a minimum, not just the mutual recognition at the end of 91 in Belavezha, but it's the Budapest Memorandum. It's the then Treaty of 97, a friendship between Ukraine and Russia, and so on and so on. So basically Russia has agreed, also again in 2010, when Yanukovych was back in power, in the so-called Kharkiv agreements, when the basing rights of the Russian naval fleet was continued until the 2040s. So all these treaties Russia has signed and ratified and agreed that Ukraine is a sovereign nation and they accept the borders. And just when Ukraine then had this revolution forward to the West and rejecting the Russian world in 2014, then all these treaties which Russia signed up to then were totally irrelevant for the Russian leadership, and they went back to mighty's right and they imposed their vision of the world on a poor neighbor. And this is the classical big power politics of the empires of the past. And we will never accept this. No matter what will happen in the future, we will never ever accept it. I would also like to say that the human rights of the, especially everybody who is against that in Crimea, is treated terrible. And there is a lot of Ukrainians who are mistreated, but also the Crimean Tatars who live there. They are also treated terrible, and Russia is a member of the Council of Europe and should treat accordingly its population, and it's not doing that, and that's a terrible shame. Yes, I think I mentioned most of the things when it comes to the future. I would like to say it's very clear that this will be never Russia, never. They can now have it for the time being because We just have no big tools to change it. We will not militarily confront Russia. But as I have made very clear, it's the best scenario for Crimea to prepare, like Saxonia did after Russian occupation, to join the free federal Ukraine, which is by then already member of NATO, the EU and the Euro. And the faster that all goes, it must be also the result that one day the Crimeans have the opportunity to return to a Ukraine, which is automatically for them also then the NATO and EU membership. That's, I think, a very realistic option, and that's what I'm advocating. It's also possible to, when Russia has the next crisis, which will inevitably come, to make a UN mission in Crimea, and also then put it 10 years under international administration. Also the same is for Donbass. It's possible also to do it, and I think I was calling from that from when I was in Ukraine a lot, UN missions, it would be the most logical way to have a 10 years international administration and then to have a referendum about independence or return to Ukraine. What will never be allowed is the annexation and the union with Russia. And this is not what we have done in the Kosovo case. That's not what we was allowed for Austria. And it's basically as a kind of a rule in international world that this kind of unions of smaller nations, of smaller regions with big empires who are aggressive, and they are not what we want and not what should be done. Maybe then some people say, but we like so much to be in Russia. Yes, okay. This you have to live with, because this is not how we, it would encourage a lot of additional expansionist ideas, because all over the world there might be some appetite of big powers to swallow some regions of the neighbors, and then it would lead to terrible consequences and wars everywhere in the world, and this should not happen. So there is this option of a referendum, which is then under 10 years of UN administration. It's a possibility. But, you know, I don't agree so much with it, because given the many international violations which Russia has done with against us and the Ukrainians, I'm very much in favor of a very simple offer to the occupied Donbass and to the occupied Crimea. That is basically returning into Ukraine, once Ukraine is already in NATO and in EU and in the Euro. And basically we have to simply make sure that Ukraine is three times richer than Crimea. Of course, optimum would be also three times richer than Russia. Russia is in decline. It's about world average. So ultimately what we have to achieve is that Ukraine is three times richer than Russia. And that's the European average. We need about 20 years of European development to achieve that, maybe 25 years, depending on the situation. But this is basically what needs to be achieved economically to be so attractive that the residents and the people in Crimea see basically their better life in the European Ukraine. And that's, I think, for me, the settlement of that. It will take another 30 years, maybe. But it will come. And even, you know, if the other variant will be with a UN mission and independence of Crimea, it will then also not be allowed to join the Russian Federation. And it will have the option to join the European Union and NATO. And that's also fine for me if that happens like this. But there will be no Russian Crimea ever in the history. Some of the extremists who want it and some of the people who are misled by Russia in the current situation, they can think that this is now happening for some time, so they sell and joy, but I can absolutely assure it will not be for the long term, and Crimea will be free again. And after all the terrible things which happened in the past of this wonderful peninsula and region, I think it's very good that there will be freedom one day. It might take a long time, maybe 50 years, but Crimea will be in Ukraine, or it will be in the European context, and it will certainly not stay with Russia. So that's the story about Crimea. Thanks a lot for your attention. And please think about Crimea, wherever you are. It's a wonderful place. And think about it, that it will be free one day and it will be part of the European world one day. As long as it takes, we will be ready. And we will never recognize such an illegal annexation, as nobody should have done also with Austria in the year 38. And it would have been a much better world if that would have happened. Good. Thanks a lot for that.